game, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the final Decade Project for 2013 in 2023. This is, of course, the One Hit Minute Production show that we do looking back 10 years. And this episode is extra special because I'm doing it with my bestest friend in the whole world. And more importantly, it's a movie that has, we immediately were on the speed train. We were on the island. We were on this movie the second that it came out. And every single time I watch it, I think about us. I think about how great this movie is, and it just continues to age like a sensational fine wine. My best friend is, of course, the talented and award-winning author. I've even collected one, Maria Lewis. Here she is.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me to discuss one of our mutually favorite films, but also specifically like one of the top films from 2013, which I think is honestly like a great cinematic year.
So many bangers. This entire Decade Project has illuminated that for me. Just like you go back and 2014's got some great ones too. But What movie are we talking about?
Only Lovers Left Alive, baby! Bow, 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 bow.
You being so reclusive and everything is probably only going to make people more interested in your music.
Yeah. What a drag.
Hello.
What is it? You look tired.
Can't you tell your wife what your problem is?
It's the way they treat the world.
And now they've succeeded in contaminating their own blood, never mind their water.
Typo negativo.
Been expecting you for some reason, Dr. Faust.
I'll come. It's just the traveling that's such a drag.
And is there a possibility of a night flight from Tangier to Detroit? Is that correct?
I love what you've done with the place.
Remember when you gave that string quintet to Schubert?
I only gave him the adagio. A dream about your sister.
Shouldn't she be sleeping in a coffin somewhere anyway? Probably with a wooden stake shoved in.
I'm really, really hungry. Do you maybe have something?
Could you smell it all the way from LA?
It's always a bit weird with family.
You're looking awfully pale there, Dr. Caligari.
Is that the really good stuff?
Precisely.
You've been pretty lucky in love, though, if I may say so.
God, I wish that I'd met him before I wrote Hamlet.
Whoa, man.
That certainly was visual.
What is that?
Oh, negative.
There never has a sound sequence better captured the essence of this subtle and powerful and graceful film as us doing the Flo Rida equivalent of bow, 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 bow. Let me hear you say languid vampires.
Oh, so 2013, Jim Jarmusch's only Lovers Left Alive. I'm talking to you, so I mispronounced it. So
the energy I want to bring to this is the same energy that Emma Stone had when she was just like tearing shreds off Bradley Cooper for an hour. So let's
really
go.
Good, really good stuff. But if you haven't seen it, it's two.
Topical.
Very topical because most people in this movie are dead, or about to be.
And trying to kill themselves.
Trying to kill themselves actively. Two vampires who live on opposite sides of the world as we encounter them. Eve, played by the absolutely incredible Tilda Swinton, and Adam, played by who at that time was the hottest actor in the world, Tom Hiddleston. Tom Hiddleston's Adam lives in Detroit. Eve lives in Tangier with their mutual mentor, her hero, Christopher Marlowe, played by John Hurt. And Adam is basically a sookie boy, and he's alone and he's by himself, and he calls to his great love from the other side of the world, and she answers, and it's a tale of them living in a decaying human society, reconnecting to sort of reaffirm why they want to continue to be immortal in this world. And it's just so damn perfect, like top to bottom. Amazing actors, two massive RIPs, Anton Yelchin.
Oh, that was, I could not stop thinking about that watching this film, because obviously, like, you know, Tom and Tilda are so fantastic, but then you have Mia Wasikowska and Anton Yelchin, and Hurt too, obviously, but particularly Mia and Anton just coming in, fucking shooting threes from side of court, guns blazing. And I was just like, God damn, I miss him. Like, this is one of his last films. He was just such a talent.
Such a talent. And a guy who was just so amazingly like, yeah, I'll be like the guy who delivers Tom Hiddleston stuff in a Jim Jarmusch film for 10 minutes. Like, he's just amazing. Just like no ego.
He was incredibly egoless, non-vain performer in almost everything that he's in, including Along Came a Spider, you know, when he's like the little the Russian ambassador's son and shit, like just with a hard Russian accent. It's just like you watch stuff with him and it's like, this is not somebody, I don't know, you've heard 1,000 people talk about how good Anton Yelchin is, I don't want to oversell it, but he just is somebody who really does feel light in things, even if they're super heavy stuff like Green Room.
Yeah.
There's just something about his performance always where it feels so assured and so concrete, even if the film around him isn't necessarily deserving of his talents, which was rare. He was a very careful picker, but, you know, Fright Night is just okay, and Odd Thomas is just okay, but he is exceptional in everything. He elevated everything he was in.
This is why I love physical media. I was looking at my Blu-ray of Only Lovers Left Alive, and I was like, oh, I haven't actually checked out the special features on this thing in a million years. Let's check what's on there. There was actually a short film called Traveling at Night with Jim Jarmusch, which is 49 minutes. It's directed by a lady by the name of Leah Rinaldi. And there's a scene, like, it's actually in the lead up to Anton Yelchin's, like, performance as Dead Body with Mia Wasikowska on the couch. And they'd been changing the lines. So it's really funny to see behind the scenes, like Tom Hiddleston's like getting the shits that the lines are changed and they're like figuring it all out and watching Jarmusch's like weird relationship with the cinematographer. You know who was fucking just amazing? Anton's sitting there with one of those gorgeous guitars that like occupy Adam's entire space in this, you know, gargantuan Detroit home that has like 20 bedrooms. He doesn't even know what's in all of them. He's basically just retrofit the entire house to be a music studio. And Anton Yelchin is just like wailing on a guitar, like completely chill and relaxed. And like everyone else is like in this high stress energy mode. And he's just like sitting on the couch, curly hair around, like just wailing. And I was just like, fuck, that guy's an artist. Like, he's just there amongst the chaos. And if you haven't had a chance to see it, you got to see him in this little short. It's amazing.
That's also one of the things about somebody who's literally grown up doing that job. Is and I imagine, like, you know, Mia Wasikowska was working from a very young age too, but like Anton Yelchin was like fucking 9 and 10 and shit in stuff and big stuff. And so if you have literally grown up with a set being your school, being your place of work for however many years, he died really young, but like he was in the game for nearly 15 years. You would have seen all kinds of shit, all kinds of people and all kinds of scenarios melting down around you. You're like, oh man, let's just roll with it. This is the business. This is the year. This is the day.
Oh, so great. So, and John Hurt, who obviously lived a long life, two completely different RIPs, but a complete legend, is in one of, if not your favorite movie of all time, Alien. getting
my literal favorite movie of all time.
Getting his chest bursts the living daylights out of. It's just sensational. So he's a legend in our mind. And low key, like, I just watched that movie American Fiction that I got a screener of that. That's out. Did a low key Jeffrey Wright double feature. Didn't even realize I was going to be doing it. I'm just like, fuck, Jeffrey Wright's in this and he's so good.
He's Jeffrey Wright again, kind of like this is one of those films where it's like everybody in this movie is one of those people where they don't miss. Like they can be in stuff that isn't good or doesn't serve them, but they are always exceptional in it. And like Jeffrey Wright is that guy. He is always really, like, you're always excited when you see him pop on screen, and you're always reassured and comfortable in the fact that, like, oh, hell yeah, there's Jeffrey Rush. Even if he's only in it for 10 minutes, this guy is going to be cooking. Fuck yeah, he's in the Hunger Games, baby. Let me see that quarter quell. What's he up to? It's a clock. Like, let's go.
All right. So if you have never, if this is your first Decade Project, welcome. We basically break down the show over a couple of segments. The first one is, how was it received initially? And at the time, I know how hard we were about this movie, but it actually had some pretty fantastic reviews. You know, like Ty Burr from the Boston Globe, who's a terrific critic, was just he called it a movie that turns one of the silliest notions into one of the most affecting movies of Jarmusch's career. Like Jason Bailey, a friend of the show, said like Only Lovers Left Alive is a hanging out movie just with vampires. You know, it had some really terrific reviews at the time. Our mutual person that we admire very much, Wesley Morris, actually hated it. He said, this movie is steeped in world weariness that flatters a certain kind of know-it-all. Swinton and Hiddleston look like twins, take disaffection to the moon. Not since The Weekend at Bernie's have two actors done more to promote the cause of corpses, which I thought was
very funny.
That's very funny.
Very good. You know what? That's why criticism fucking rules, dog. Because it's like, you know what? It's fine. You can have like different opinions, but it's craft. Like, I don't care if I like a film and you hate it. If the reasons you're telling me about why you dislike it are factual and interesting, and you craft a banger lead and a banger sentence, like, I'm along for the ride. Let me hear your wrong opinion. That's cool.
Yeah, that was a great wrong opinion. But pivoting from that, Australia's premier.
He has points. No, he's got points. But I just personally disagree.
He's got points. But of course, you know, he's Wesley Morris. So I'll read anything he writes about any film, to be honest. Now, this one is close to our heart. A man scolded us on the highest rated show ever in Australian cultural criticism at the movies. David Stratton said, I think this is certainly an original and unusual film.
Oh my God. This should be right up his fucking alley. It's slow and it's like poetry and it's genre, but also at the same time, it's genre in a classy way.
No, it's genre from America, so it's fine.
Well, but if he squinted, it's very European. Like, let's be honest. Like, it's America, but it's like, it is, but it isn't. But if he squinted with his beady little eyes, he could pretend this isn't fucking genre at all, and then he'd be so happy.
Oh my God. So at the time, without being sort of crazy, like a crazy critical reception that had people sort of gushing about it uniformly, it had a big impact on the both of us. I remember we saw it together and we're just like, this is exactly the kind of
immediately obsessed. Had we seen it together? I actually was thinking about this before we did the show. Had we seen it together or no? Because I feel like we had seen it separately and then came together at my house. And we're both like, what? And no. Immediately trying to recreate the poster.
No. Well, no. You're close. I think we saw it separately and then went to Dendy in Newtown and actually saw it again together so we could be sitting together. And then we walk back to your house. Shout out to Angel Street. We walk back to your house. And took a classic photo in our friendship. Immediately obsessed with that movie. Immediately. I left work and you're like, do you want to go see Only Lovers Left Alive? I'm like, yeah. Yeah, 100%. Let's go.
Can you hear that?
No, what is it?
My neighbor's fucking. Yeah. Oh shit. Anyway, that's Atmos, baby.
That's, look, we're talking about a very sensual and sexual movie, and just someone, there's only lovers screaming out shagging right next to your house right now.
In Finnish. That's why I can never, I only realized that I can never understand what
Lapland. Lapland, baby.
So sorry, I interrupted you. Carry on.
How can I carry on? Can you hear that?
She's gonna come soon, so don't worry about it. Let's go. Hang on. She's coming. She's coming. And we're good. Let's go.
Oh my God. So funny. So that was then at the time. Now, this feels so strange because Jim Jarmusch was like a guy who on that specific time that he made it was on a bit of a tear. Like he was, so if you go from like Ghost Dog 99, then like Coffee and Cigarettes 2003, 2005 is Broken Flowers, which is kind of big. He then does, he kind of has a little lapse, Limits of Our Control, which is okay. Then he goes Only Lovers Left Alive, Patterson. Then he does The Dead Don't Die. And that's kind of like 2019. And it's now just
and
a little.
Gimme Danger.
And Gimme Danger, yeah. Gimme Danger too. But he has this kind of like a couple of like little patches where you're like bang, 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 Jarmusch, Jarmusch, Jarmusch. It's like huge. He was always this independent presence. But then this happens. And I feel like when people go back and they talk about all the great films that they love of his, this is never one of them.
You know, it's so funny you say that because I too was thinking about that specifically, but also this film, because I feel like at the time it was very appreciated and acknowledged. However, in hindsight now, like that we have, you know, the clarity of a decade, this is the decade project, et cetera, I feel like people don't talk about this film in the same way that even other vampiric films of this era, because What We Do in the Shadows came out just after this, right?
Yeah, 2014.
Also, you know, Dracula Untold, shit like that. But you know what I mean? Like there are a lot of other vampiric properties that came out around the same time that I feel have much more pop cultural real estate present day in a way that Only Lovers Left Alive doesn't. And, you know, the people who love it, but it hasn't been one of those films that I feel has had a developing cult fan base.
Yeah.
It almost feels a little bit like lost to time, like one of his true lost classics. And maybe it's something like, and I'm just thinking of like another great genre property that's also very poetic and languid and odd like this, but not vampires. This little Aussie horror film called Celia, which came out in the 80s and like was sort of, you know, was really well received at the time and did the similar sort of things like Only Lovers Left Alive did on an international festival circuit. It was obviously like a big like Cannes situation. The French are fucking weird, so who knows what they're into. Pedophiles. But anyway, but it was one of those films that, you know, blew up sort of on the festival circuit in the way that something like Celia did. But Celia is having a bit of a resurgence now, and it's, you know, 30 something years later. And I hope it doesn't take 30 years for Only Lovers Left Alive to find its level again. But it just is one of those films that even these individual actors, if you talk about Tilda, Anton, Jeffrey Wright has a tiny part, Mia Wasikowska, Tom Hiddleston, even John Hurt, but John Hurt, again, really long filmography, similar to like Tilda, where you're just like always putting shit out, we're bouncing from the stage to the screen. This is not a film that gets brought up in their canon, which I find so fascinating. And I really am curious as to what that is. Because I'll be truthful, I'm not much of a Jimmy J. girly. Like he's
no,
he's
that was going to be, that was going to be one of my questions, because I'm also not a Jimmy J. guy. Uh-uh. Like there's a few of his films that I really love. And like, I have like a real affinity in a strange way for like Coffee and Cigarettes, because it's just one of those like great, like episodic, silly movies that has all these great, wonderful actors and faces.
That was going to be one of the ones I cited as just, oh, fuck, I hate this shit.
Yeah, no, but like,
I have to study it in film school and shit. I'm like, oh, God, we get it. You smoke ciggies, get a grip.
And here's me over here just going, oh, my God, I just want to.
Oh, just, look at this one cigarette. I'm like, oh, I could go with a coffee at 9 o'clock at night. So that's my way friend.
Yeah, you know, we go together like coffee and cigarettes, but I was just going to say, but I don't hear anyone talking about this. And you mentioned this, which I thought was really spot on, is there was a bit of a moment when we were in the Twilight era of other kinds of vampire movies coming out that were getting dwarfed by it. And so one of the ones I thought of was firstly, which is like Let the Right One In, which then got remade as Let Me In by Matt Reeves.
Which, gotta say, to be honest, the American remake was the one that I preferred.
Yeah.
That I enjoyed that film a lot more. But like you talk about Twilight, Twilight saga is only finishing in 2012.
Yeah.
And that last film comes out November because they had that November release slot every year for fucking the 86 years they stretched those four books out across. And so this is right within Twilight Mania. Like the tail hasn't dropped off yet. Yeah, Vampire Academy, one of my films, and which has been a real, like, you too on the Vampire Academy train because we love that Russian guy. But Zoe Deutsch as well is
Zoe Deutsch.
So charming and delightful. And there's just this vampiric moment happening that is really interesting. True Blood as well. Like, you had multiple seasons.
Oh, that show was massive then. It was everywhere. My God.
And it was really the show that its success set up things like Game of Thrones, where it's like, you know, joke about big HBO shows, people think Sopranos and The Wire, for sure, totally agree. But True Blood was the show that had that.
That's the Game of Thrones template, because it's
exactly what I was just about to get to.
It's fantasy and tits.
R rated. It had tits. It had high fantastical elements. It was based on books and source material that had an inbuilt fan base. And at the time, before Game of Thrones became the TV phenomenon that it was, the actual cultural reach of George R. R. Martin's books wasn't that different from Charlene Harris's books with the Sookie Stackhouse series. So there's a lot of comparisons there, but this is like right within the vampire hotspot. And so I feel like maybe things like this, where they're like, we're trying to do Byzantium, one of my favorite films of all time, came out in this era, where they're trying to do vampiric movies that are a little bit different to fucking Mormon vampires, that was sort of the era where stuff like this had a moment to sparkle.
And the next year, 2014, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, which is an independent, like an independent horror Western vampire protagonist story, did huge festival stuff and was like lauded and was on so many top 10 lists and it like was a smash. Yet the movie that's got Tilda, who everyone loves, and Tom Hiddleston, who at the time, this is pre the Taylor Swift, what was it, the Taylor Swift feature that was in the, was in like Variety or whatever. It was all pre that time. He was the coolest motherfucker out there. Like
he hadn't
just
even dated her yet. So no, this he was pre.
He's come off the top of Avengers, which is the year before, which is absolutely gigantic. He's so well loved. And it's like, okay. It just disappeared, and I can't fathom why.
Well, the other thing that's so interesting about this is that part of Adam was originally made for Michael Fassbender. Like, he was supposed to be the person playing that part. Isn't that interesting?
Wow.
And I think it's so fascinating because would you ever compare the two of them? Like, they're both, like, very sinewy. And they're sinewy and they're good actors. But the thing they really have in common is they both, and especially at that time around 2013, were straddling the line between mainstream studio films and franchises. Because Fassbender was obviously like in the X-Men movies, he'd just done Prometheus, stuff like that. So straddling that line, well, also 2013 for him was the year 12 Years a Slave comes out. And he's like one of, like, you know, on the Mount Rushmore of worst white men ever. And The Counselor, one of your favorites, you know? And then it's like,
love
it's
The Counselor so much.
It's Light Between Oceans. It's like all these like really interesting things. And it's so fascinating. If you look at their filmographies side by side and line up the timelines, they're doing quite similar work, like really quite similar work. And they have that same level of critical acclaim. It's just that I would say Michael Fassbender didn't have the people love him, but he didn't necessarily court the fandom and court fans in the same way that Tom Hiddleston's out here doing, you know, the fucking two-step on Graham Norton, and then he's doing the wiggle over here on, you know, James Corden, and then he's out here doing a backwards electric slide over on Jimmy Fallon. You know what I mean? Like, he works for it and was working for it in a way that Michael Fassbender's like, I don't know, man, maybe I'll just dip from Hollywood for a bit and go, like, fucking drive cars. I don't know. What do you reckon? Yeah? Nah?
Yeah, just yeah? For, okay, I'll just take three. I'll take 3 years off. I'm not fucking around with you guys. I'm good, which I respect so much, actually, that when you can do that and just dip out and be like, all right, I'm going to go and I'll come back and I'll do a couple of movies.
Just like Patrick Dempsey, you know?
Patrick Dempsey. Big Ferrari guy, Michael Mann guy, old Patrick Dempsey these days, huh? Excited?
People's sexiest man, allegedly.
Yeah, allegedly. It is a big allegedly. It's always.
You like, oh man, I could get into the politics of the whole decision, but like, people have to accept it. You don't just get like, you just don't get given it. It's like, they have a list of people that they're like, okay, here's our 15-ish people we want. Let's start at the top of the list and work our way down. Because they've gone to Ryan Gosling multiple times and he's like, fuck that, I don't want that shit. Because then you have to do an exclusive cover shoot with them and an interview and everything. And it really is dependent on who's courting that client.
I was just going to say, Gosling this year as Ken, surely.
Is the one. But it's also like Glenn Powell found dead somewhere in a ditch because you know he wanted that. Like, you know, he's watching fucking Patrick Dempsey, who also left, you know, after getting fired off Grey's Anatomy, goes to fucking drive cars for a bit. And Glenn Powell is just out here doing everything he can to just stay alive and stay afloat. And he's just like biting into his fist, screaming that Patrick Dempsey was the one they gave it to when, you know, it would have been perfect timing wise for anyone but you. Instead, he had to go and show his hole on the men's the men's health cover shoot. So, you know, live, laugh, love.
Show his hole.
Haven't you seen that shot where it's his, like, not the ass I would desire, but each to their own. But he's out there with his butt. And the gays went full conspiracy theorist in a way that I love, because in the Anyone But You trailer, there's a shot of him and Sydney Sweeney's bare butts. And his butt in that trailer is like, you know, he's been doing some squats, he's been working out, he's like this anaconda don't want none. And then the men's health shoot, it's go girl, give me nothing of butts. And so the gays were comparing, contrasting whether he'd had a CGI butt like Tom Cruise in Valkyrie. Very interesting stuff.
Bless the gays for their conspiracy theories. Shout out to all of you who are listening. We love you.
The world's bravest soldiers, truly.
If when pop culture needs soldiers, it's the gays. They will find out everything. Bless them.
They're on the front lines in Rihanna's Navy, and they are forging ahead.
Oh, bless. Now, let's just take the quickest of breaks, and then we're going to come back and try and unpack a little bit about what happened, why it didn't resonate, and maybe a couple of like sliding doors moments. Let's take a quick break. Alrighty, we're back. We're still trying to figure out. We've just been shouting out our dear friends, the gays, for their work on conspiracy theory of Glenn Powell's bum. A massive perfect digression that is pretty much par for the course on this show and par for the course of any Maria and I conversation. But
also not irrelevant. Lots of nudity in this.
Lots of nudity. Let's get to that. I watched this again and I think Tom Hiddleston's doing seriously some of his best work in this movie, but Tilda Swinton, God, doesn't she just make everyone look awful sometimes next to how amazing she is? Like, she's just so good. And I love everything about the way that these vampires operate in the world. I love that the primary setting is Detroit, which is decaying. I love that there's a whole system by which that he goes out of his house to get like pure blood, you know, because humans have poisoned themselves and have contaminated themselves. So that's how we, just like we have polluted the earth, we've contaminated their food source, which is us. I love all of the little bits and pieces in this movie. I think just they're all so understated, and all of the component parts are so cool when you connect them together. And you think of the way that the movie tells that story and adds these little bits of background and fleshing out of the story. I can't get enough of it. It's so clever. And I know you as a fantasy writer would just be eating up how the characters tell so much about themselves by the culture that they consume and the culture that's around them.
Well, it's the Detroit thing so fascinating, because I also think that has one of my favorite lines and favorite moments from the movie, where they go to Jack White's old house and they're like, little baby Jack White.
Little baby Jack White.
So funny, because, you know, like obviously coffee and cigarettes, blah, blah, blah. But it's also such a nice little moment, because part of the sort of like ongoing catalyst for the story is one half of another person's soul trying to make the person who's kind of giving up on life and giving up on living, trying to make them excited about life again. And the way they do that, and the way she tries to get him excited about life, is essentially by exploring art, like music and movies and culture and being around life and the way that we express life, books. There's a bit where one of the pseudonyms she uses is Fibonacci. And I'm like, oh my God, the Fibonacci sequence. Like the alias fan and me just jumped out. I was like, whoa, they're going to get into Ramboli next. Never let it go. You know, those are cool memories and cool moments. But it was just such an interesting bit, because a lot of the culture that they're talking about is big picture stuff. You know, it's Shakespeare and it's Heady and it's orchestras and it's music. But it's also like accessible pop culture. The White Stripes and the idea of Jack White and like some of the other references that they make is really compelling to me, in a way that that's like a micro example, or like a micro textual example of what the macro thing this film is doing, which is a very mainstream pop culture, fast food type, accessible, one word selling point, vampires, but doing something very high art and artistic and intentional and in many ways unconventional in his execution of vampires. Now, that, what's that movie he did about zombies later? Fucking Dead Don't Die or some shit?
The Dead Don't Die. I think the longer title was The Dead Don't Die or some shit, but yeah, I think how it was released in Australia was The Dead Don't Die.
I actually quite like that film, but it lacks all of the subtlety that only Lovers Left Alive does. And, yeah, you know, like zombies are a horde. You can't do like an intimate zombie drama, but you can do that with vampires. It's about the what monster you're choosing to say what thing. And just sort of the idea of these like two souls just sort of intertwined through time, moving through the world, is just such a compelling idea. But it's also the way that it's executed that is so fascinating. And them sort of being in the ruins of humanity and in the ruins of Detroit. And it's just really rich, rich stuff. It's a dark chocolate film. That's how it feels, where you're just like, oh man, flavors bursting off your tongue, and like a bitterness and a really like gradual acquired taste to it, as opposed to just like fucking Maltesers in a bag, which I also love. Don't get me wrong. But you know, some days a girl just wants some 80% cocoa.
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it. And there's some great conversations too. And I was one that I thought of particularly tonight, thinking about you, where Tilda's Eve is asking Adam, she's like, tell me about Byron. And he was like, well, he was a freaking, he was a stuck up. He was like, you know, he was completely up himself. He was up his own ass. And she goes, oh, but tell me about Mary. And then,
yeah!
and then Adam looks over and he goes, oh, she was delicious. and then she goes, oh, I bet she was.
And you know what? She lost her virginity on her mother's grave at 19 to a married man. She fucking was delicious. Correct, sir, correct. Wrote one of the greatest and most seminal pieces of genre art ever, because she was like, fuck Byron and fuck these dumb men who think they're God. Like, that's delicious. If that's not what delicious means, then fuck it. I don't want to know.
The original science fiction text. The great, yeah. the seminal, the canonical one. But yeah, there's so many moments like that here. And, you know, there's so many moments and little touches that are great, and some things work better than others. But you're so right about, it's just like, it's just trying to find your way in the world. And I also love in this movie, and it's maybe it's because we're coming out of like Oppenheimer time, and you hear about like all these scientists that were around Oppenheimer that were their sort of own rock stars in different fields of science and stuff like later on themselves. But like, this is like gushing about great scientist movies. Like Newton is mentioned and Galileo is mentioned and Tesla is mentioned. It's like, and it's really cool to see like that they see artists in intellectual pursuits, not just music and not just writing, but it's like, well, scientists are the fucking, they're the people.
It's so funny you make the Oppenheimer comparison, because there is that great line in Oppenheimer where Matt Damon is like, brilliance in your field is a given. Like, yes. He's just like, I'm unimpressed by brilliant. You're all fucking brilliant. Like, get a grip. Anyway, but there's that beautiful sequence in the what must be the opening 20 minutes of the film. It's really hard to gauge time in a Nolan joint. But where Oppenheimer is in Germany and he's like, he's learning about Cubism and the Cubist movement. And he's starting to explore music. And all these other art forms are converging at the same time as his ideas are converging RE science. And understand, like, the way Nolan's able to sort of combine those theories and those ideas all together, I was like, this is why he rocks. Like, this is why he's the GOAT, man. Like, truly. And in like, watching Only Lovers Left Alive recently, I was like, wonder if Nolan just, like, loves this shit. I wonder if this is, like, date night for him and Emma. Is they just, like, chilling out, playing Adam and Eve, watching this film? Because it is just, it's such an even though they're so, like, playing it low-key and so dour and everything about the performances is subtle and chill, it's such a loud movie about loving life, which is so weird when you think about, you know, all the things that it is.
I think Nolan is totally the kind of guy that would answer a FaceTime call using an old laptop and like one of those old TVs that has like knobs on it and like with like weird buttons so and funny. Tweakers and stuff like that. I totally think that's in his wheelhouse. So I think he would have a lot of fun with this. So let's, did you have any more like little bits of trivia? Because that one is amazing that it was originally a Fassbender. So I want to know.
Isn't that fascinating? Well, also because, this year, having watched The Killer and Michael Fassbender and Tilda Swinton, getting to have, like, the great big sort of tête-à-tête of the film, right?
The best scene of the film.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't include Syla Baker smashing Michael Fassbender through a wall, which I definitely do, but it was so fascinating watching that scene. And in my head, not the first time, but the second time I was watching The Killer, it was like the energy that they have, and they are playing very different parts, but it's not that far removed. Like, the pace and the mood and the tone of The Killer is actually like a quite nice double bill for something like Only Lovers Left Alive. Like, I think they would pair very well together. And just sort of seeing the texture between Fassbender and Tilda Swinton a decade after they did this is really, really interesting to see. I think Tom Hiddleston is the right person for it. Because it's also, you know, she's Scottish, he's British, and the two of them had worked together previously and circled each other on the theatre circuit for forever. Like, he was like a big, like, bad bitch, he's the bar, you know, theatre superstar for years before he blew up with, you know, all his fucking film work and shit. But, like, that was the thing that...
Until he became in Disney low-key purgatory. So he's just, like, never going to stop playing that character. That was the other thing that I was watching this movie. I was like, he was a superstar. Theater comes out, does these huge movies. It's, like, fantastic. He's going to be a guy. Like, he's like, you watch Only Lovers Left Alive. Oh, man, he's going to be, like, one of the guys. He's going to be around. And now all he does is these movies. And it's just like, where is the Tom Hiddleston who was going to be out there like looking for crime roles, doing a heist, well, those sorts of things.
To be fair, when he we know him through, he's been famous at a certain level for like 15 years, right?
Yeah.
But when he was first when he was the bad bitch of theater and everyone was like, no Hiddleston, no play kind of vibe. Every time he tried to push and forge forward into the screen space, largely through television, it was always in British period dramas. And it was just like, a lot of Austen shit and playing Charles Darwin and crap like that. Not crap like that, whatever. Paul Bettany's done it too, fine. Everyone has to do their time in the fucking Charles Darwin trenches, right? But 2011 is the year for him where, and I remember this so specifically because I interviewed him that year for truly one of the worst films. It's called War Horse, as I'm sure you know. I actually went dressed up as War Horse to an Oscars party that year. It was incredible costume, like 12 out of 10 no notes, one of my best. But in 2011, he does Thor. He has a scene-stealing part in Midnight in Paris.
Yeah, he's great. Scott Fitzgerald.
Oh, my God. He's definitely in War Horse, which is like he's very good in it, but, like, truly, who gives a fuck? Like, that film is just, like, lost to the fucking trenches.
You're not a horse girly, clearly, because I remember on a plane, my wife, one Sam Howard, who you love dearly, watched that movie and sobbed like it was like one of the most impactful epics she'd ever seen.
Well, the thing that just also always got me is like War Horse was obviously based on a hit stage play. And when I looked up the pictures of the stage play and this horse was fucking made of twigs and shit, I was like, how people take this seriously? A bunch of people like projecting all of their shit during World War One, famously a terrible time for all involved. And they're all just like, hell yeah, man, this bundle of twigs. Like, never have I loved a thing like I've loved this bundle of twigs. So, like, this sucks. And somehow the film was worse. But there is that one shot that I do think about as he's, like, on the aforementioned war horse plowing into a line of German artillery. And he's been such a, like, aspirational, courageous character up until this moment. And then as he's like, they're all there, the fucking cavalry charging in, there's this moment on his face where his face kind of drops as he sees the guns and he's like, oh, I'm about to die. This means nothing. This meant nothing. And he dies. But anyway, and Deep Blue Sea was the other thing that came out that year. And then, so his four movies.
Not the good one.
Not Deep as Blue as My Hat is Like a Shark's Fin. Instead, he was going deep into Rachel Weisz's Blue, if you know what I mean. And it was just like, that's four films in one year, right?
Yeah.
Notable films, like extremely notable. All of those films are significant in some capacity or another. And then straight after that, out comes fucking Avengers the next year. And then, he does a few other like theater bits here and there and, blah, blah, blah. And then it's fucking Only Love is Left Alive. And then we're into the era of like, Tom Hiddleston-ing for the rest of time. But it's just like, it's so fascinating. I think that's why this business interests me so much, is like, that's somebody who was genuinely like working and grinding for a decade,
on the
stage and in the screen, and originally auditioned for Thor because Kenneth Branagh had loved his work on stage, auditioned for the part of Thor, not of Loki. And then didn't get the part. And they're like, hey, man, what about this fucking greasy guy over here instead? And his performance and his portrayal is one of the sort of most enduring things about Marvel. Like, still to this day, it's like the things that he was able to do with that character and how he was able to make a villain sing he did it so well that it's been a problem for Marvel ever since, in terms of like, they've always had a villain problem. Because they got really fucking lucky with their first few and he just set the bar so high.
Yeah.
That, when it does get to be Lee Pace and body paint, like Lee Pace is incredible too, but fucking, he didn't have the deliciousness that.
It does, and Lee Pace's Instagram is where all the deliciousness lies.
Girl. 6'7". It's just so crazy. It's crazy. I actually can't, like, I don't follow him and I can't look at it, but every now and again my explore tab's like, I know what you want, you big slut. And it's just like, it's hard to look directly at him because it's just, and you know, especially when he's out there with his partner at like a Tom Brown show and he's wearing those slutty little shorts with the high-waisted socks, and I'm just like, ah, like, you know, punching the wall, Adam Driver stuff. But okay, this isn't trivia, but the other thing I just want to mention before we move on to other sections is, again, Anton Yelchin, like, this really is Tom and Tilda's show. And then you have all these bit players in and around. You have John Hurt, you have Jeffrey Wright, you have Anton. But Mia Wasikowska does such an incredible job.
Oh my God.
Of encapsulating how annoying Australian women are. That it is, it is truly just like, it's so Australian coded, even though she's not playing an Australian character. But I'm just like, this is somebody who has lived this, right? Anyway.
This is someone who, like, and this is the, you nailed it that it's Australian coded, because I hadn't put that together, but I was, that was one of my points I wanted to bring up to you was, she like hurts you. You're like, oh, she's like one of those people, like a cousin that you're out of touch with, and you try and do the nice thing, and she just fucks up everything. And you're like, you know, these people in your life, you know, they come in and you're like, get the fuck out of my house. I did love the line. Go back to, go back and fucking rot in LA. It's a, it's very fun.
So LA.
Oh,
and it's
God.
Just, you do want to talk about people's runs and their timing, right? Because she blows up with Alice in Wonderland, and that's kind of the thing that puts her on the map, even though, you know, she was really one of the breakout stars of In Treatment, like, has such an incredible performance in that. But, like, just let's just talk about her run. If we, let's bookmark it, this period of her career, from Alice in Wonderland as starting point to Alice in Wonderland 2 as the end point. This is, this is her run. The Kids Are All Right, which fucking slaps, fucking slaps.
Great Jane movie.
Fucking Eyre, boy.
Killer movie.
Harry Fukunaga on his bullshit. Michael Fassbender on his fucking bullshit. Again, all these people keep crossing over with each other in weird ways. Restless, I actually think, is really underrated. People don't love it. Oh, no, they didn't love it at the time. They were just like, this is a bit slow. And there'd been a few sort of like teenish melodramas like Remember Me and shit, where Robert Pattinson gets 9/11 and everyone's like, do we want to do this? And then a few sick, like, period dramas back to back. Albert Nobbs, which is great, like, is great, and also has Janik McTeer flashing some of the best tits I've ever seen in my life. Like, that's, there's lots of things to remember at that movie, but I do just remember so clearly the scene where she flashes her tits at Glenn Close's Albert Nobbs, and I'm just like, that's the best rack I've ever seen. Lawless, which fucking bangs, we love that film. Stoker, goddamn incredible.
Stoker is 20 out of 10.
Incredible. Trax is
a great movie.
Amazing.
And another great. You don't usually like that kind of thing.
Well, I just don't usually like movies with that much sand, but it's just, it's beautiful. And it's just like, she's so good. And it's such an interesting story. And it's shot like a motherfucker. The Double, which is super weird. Maps to the Stars, throwing a little Cronenberg joint. Madame Bovary. And then fucking Crimson Peak is the last thing she does before falling into the Alice in Wonderland trenches. Like, secure the bag, babe, off you go. But that is an incredible, like, she is, and she, post Alice in Wonderland, she is, I feel, also done lots of great interest.
Oh, The Devil All the Time is terrific. Bergman Island was huge.
Judy and Punch is amazing.
I haven't seen Judy and Punch.
Judy and Punch is really, really good. It's got your boy Damien in it. Damien Harriman, and he plays that fermented punch, really. But it's also a Gone Girl tie-in because of the whole Judy and Punch Dolls thing. But she's somebody who's a really careful chooser. Like, she picks and chooses really carefully. Mm. She's really respected for her craft. But my God, Only Love Is Left Alive, being in the middle of that run, that's like 12 films back to back. They're fucking sensational. It's crazy.
I mean, even...
she's so underrated.
Like you said... between Alice in Wonderland, which is 2010, so you assume she's shooting that early 2010, maybe 2009, she does that, Jane Eyre, Restless, Albert Nobbs, Lawless, Stoker, Trax, and Only Lovers Left Alive, and The Double, all between 2009, 10, and 13. That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 films.
And it's like Maps of the Stars as well, like smaller part, but she's in the top 4 cast members on all of these films. If not,
crazy.
In the case of something like Tracks and Stoker, where she is one
she
of
is the movie
leads. Yeah, exactly. Lawless, again, she's a smaller part of the ensemble. Albert Nobbs, part of the ensemble. Kids Are All Right, part of the ensemble. But just, my God, like, she's so impressive. Crimson Peak is such an incredible film.
She's great
in
it.
She gives such an incredible performance. And again, working with Tom Hiddleston, like, the people that, whatever Jimmy J, like, was in the water with the people that he was choosing, you know, even though Michael Fassbender doesn't end up in this, the Michael Fassbender, Mia, Tilda, Tom, all keep sort of like circulating and percolating around each other in a way that whatever chemistry he could taste, like, it was like, it's still there in them. And other casting directors see it too, because they're putting people in variations of these same combinations. It's really, really interesting shit.
It's, yeah, and she's so good in this movie, because she is usually put as the sweet girl. And I think that what's so good about Mia is that she likes being sort of sweet, and they put her in period films where she has to kind of be very measured. But this is a loud, loud performance, and she has met or is possibly blood related to this character in real life. Like, she is just, her level of like taking the piss annoying is, like, this is the kind of person who you are going to encounter this Christmas. Like, this is someone who you're related to.
It's so funny, because she's never done any other part like this. Like, actually, there's a few little cameos in black comedy and shit like that, but that's a thing nobody outside of Australia or ABC has seen. But it's just like, this is such an unusual role for her. And yes, she has done lots of period stuff, but she also plays lots of dark characters. Like, even if they're, you know, seemingly like put together girls on the surface, I'm thinking of Stoker and Jane Eyre, but they have an edge to them. They have a darkness to them, a gumption, if you will. And it's just very, really, really fascinating stuff. I also thought that, they're completely different parts, but Saoirse Ronan and Mia Wasikowska, there had been a, like, you know, sort of like what if casting thing about Mia Wasikowska either auditioning and not getting, or going up for the role that Saoirse Ronan plays in Byzantium. And it ended up going to Saoirse Ronan instead. I find that so interesting, because I think you could have swapped out Saoirse and put her in Only Lovers Left Alive and put Mia in Byzantium, and had almost like those two women, to me, are two of the best actresses of their generation. But they are interchangeable in those parts. Like, that's how good they are, and both how good those films are. And they're both like sort of gothic films about vampirism.
I think Mia has I used to be on Neighbours, and now I'm a chaotic Australian actress that's going to live on people's couches in LA vibes. It reminds me so much of someone we know, but we're keeping that for the group chat. But what I was going
to
say,
She won't listen to this. You're fine. You're safe.
But what I was going to say is, I would have loved a fucking chaotic Irish energy to that. Like, can you imagine Saoirse?
No, but I don't say, this is the thing. I think Saoirse would have played it like LA as well. Like, I could see her, the dumb bitchery of this part and like the ditziness of it. I could see her really leaning into this and doing it in a really fun way that, to be honest, I don't really think she had in her until I watched Lady Bird and was like, oh, okay, cool. Fascinating. Interesting. You know?
Yeah. It's so good, man. This movie is so, so good. Last thing we usually talk about on our decade projects is like, what did we learn? And it's like, I just learned that this movie has disappeared and for no apparent reason. There's like,
Thought about that too? Was that something you were thinking about heading into this? Because it's a little bit hard to perceive outside of the bubble of me and you just circle jerking the like 12 things we're passionate about. Hey, you know what I mean?
Well, that's one. But I was
for you.
But I was just gonna say, like, usually when I've done decade project things, like in some of the last episodes, you know, you talk about, I spoke to Gavin Mevious from Mixed Reviews podcast, who you were on their show recently.
Love
Gavin.
Oh, he's such a scholar.
He's terrific. We were talking about the Before trilogy because we're talking about Before Midnight, because that was 2013 as well. And so then I went and did the digging. And so you dig and there's heaps of articles about this. And I guess the lesson for that one, for folks who are probably going to listen to that one shortly, if you haven't already, was like, oh, there was a moment between now and then that the Before trilogy became canonically like a cinema trilogy that everyone had to see. Like, and we kind of were trying to track exactly when that happened and those things. And so I try and do the same thing on all decade projects. What I noticed is there is a loud silence around this movie. There's no like features. There's no like retrospectives. It's not on vampire movie lists readily that either A, you've written, or B, I've written.
There you fucking go. Because when I Googled it, one of the searches that came up was stuff that we had written on graffiti.
Yes, yes.
And like I had done a piece on it at the Daily, I was working at the Daily Telegraph at the time and had done a piece on it for the Daily Telegraph. And it was just like very interesting because like this is a decade. Our shit that we wrote about this film at the time shouldn't be that high up in the search terms.
No way.
Usually it gets populated with not only more recent pieces, but pieces that have new clicks. And so it feels like I did partially wonder if maybe this is an accessibility issue. Now, you know, each their own. In America, everyone has a different service and a different system. But here, you can't watch this movie for free. It is not available. You need to rent it or buy it. I haven't seen a physical release for it. Have you?
I have a physical release. And do you know how I have it? I think I bought it in 2014. I think I got it in 2014 when it came out. So I've had the Blu-ray for like 10 years.
But like, so this is the thing. It becomes if this hit Netflix, I would be very interested to see.
Especially US Netflix. US Netflix around this time, just like go bang, drop it. See what happens.
And it just, you know, the way that certain things can just resurge and Suits is the example that everybody uses, but it happens with films all the time as well. It's really, really interesting stuff. Like even the Anaconda is a film that I've always rode really hard for, but the amount of Anaconda memes and content I've seen in the past 12 months has reached a level that's so absurd. And it's like nobody was.
And I think I send you a new one like every 3 days.
Every day.
And all funny. They're all funny.
But you know why it is? It hit Netflix. Anaconda hit Netflix. It's accessible to people again. I remember when Fear, one of my all-time favorite films and baby's first psychosexual thriller. I remember when that hit Netflix and was in the top 10 for like weeks because people were like, is he going to fuck this bitch on a roller coaster? Like, holy shit. Like they could not, and they're like, oh my God, is her dad trying to fuck her? Like, is this whole thing like a cockfight between her dad and her psych? Is that a Solano about to fuck an entire what is going on? Like, it was just one of those things where people couldn't believe what they were watching, but that film entered the discourse again because it was accessible. And, you know, it doesn't have to be Netflix. It could be, it's not going to be Max, but it could be Disney Plus or something. But it's just the sort of thing where I think maybe part of the reason this feels like it has died in a conversational vacuum is because it's not accessible for people.
And also when you think of this, the other thing that I'm super passionate about is like physical media. Like this is also ripe for like, Tilda's out there doing interviews for The Killer and Asteroid City. Tom Hiddleston is out there constantly for Loki because he's like he's the engine, the personality, all of that they're hanging so much of this like weird nexus of Marvel's current state, both in cinema and television. It's sort of all over the place. And it's like no one mentions it. And it's also that, you know, Jim Jarmusch, to your point, right? Like, he hasn't really done much since The Dead Don't Die, if really anything. It's like it's hard to see. So it's Jim Jarmusch is like a legend of independent cinema. So it's really strange that like we're not seeing something like this, especially after, you know, Patterson and then Gimme Danger and then The Dead Don't Die.
I gotta be honest, I really hate Patterson. But just to quickly Also, I know you would. One of the, just was like, I bet you love this shit. But one of the other things, like conditional elements, like this, not, I feel genuinely, I think both of us are like, this is not reflective of the film or the quality of film. It's reflective of the societal conditions and how the film business has changed, right? So lack of access to it in physical media form and or streaming, but also the death of film journalism and pop culture commentary and critique. There are so many places and publications that we worked for and have worked for that do not exist anymore that would have written pieces on this film back then, but also would have written 10th anniversary pieces on it. And not just like a little peek behind the curtains. This is some real hack shit, but I used to pull this all the time. But you would get an interview with somebody about some present day project and you'd be like, man, I don't really care about a dog's purpose, but what I really want to talk to Harrison Ford about is, okay, not Star Wars, but like what lies beneath. I
what
know
lies
it's coming
beneath.
Up to a
yes.
What Lies Beneath anniversary or like whatever. So you would interview that actor for that particular current film and you would save usually your last question, maybe your last two questions, and you would dedicate them to something odd. And if it was Harrison Ford, for me, it would be What Lies Beneath. Tom Hiddleston, for me, it would be Only Love Is Left Alive. So say you were interviewing Tom Hiddleston on the Loki season 2 press circuit and back in the Dizzle where there used to be longer form pieces and, you know, shit like that existed out there. And you had more than 1.5 journalists doing the job of 12 people in a film or in a specific round. You would ask a question about Only Love Is Left Alive and do a retrospective piece. But the problem is there are not very many arts journalists that exist anymore. And the ones that do are so strapped and like so.
Well, they've got assignments. Like
they're flying by the seat of their pants. But also, even if they did write this article, there's nowhere left to publish it. That is the problem. And so it's the kind of thing where when this film came out, it was very rich in the days of film blogging and film discussion places. But it's just, it's kind of like the ringer or death, really.
Yes, yes. And it's also a multi-quadrant film in that you got Jarmusch, who has such a legendary status as a hugely influential and important American independent filmmaker, and like a guy who you were being taught about in film school, and a guy certainly I was at university when we're talking about American filmmakers and American independent filmmakers. But then you've got like Tom Hiddleston, who's still one of the biggest stars in the world. You've got Tilda Swinton, who is like one of the most beloved people. So it's just like always feels like, wow. So yeah, there's a bit of a vacuum, but that's part of the reason why this is an essential but also like exciting film for me to do here. It's because it's like in so many of the others, there's a lot of chatter. There's a lot of filmmakers who've gotten bigger. It's like, yes, Prisoners is being found again because of Netflix, but Denis Villeneuve, people are talking about him because of Dune.
Is that true?
Being found.
Did you just make that up or is that true?
It's been on Australian Netflix and is consistently in the carousel for me for like months.
That's not reflective of, they know your fucking shit. They're like, man, look at this sick fuck. He's going to love like him.
No, you talk about
give him what he wants.
But it's the Jake Gyllenhaal memes from that movie.
Yeah. He's, to be honest, that's the only time I've ever found Jake Gyllenhaal hot. Genuinely, the only time I've ever found him hot was in Prison.
That and Nightcrawler, that's you.
No, Nightcrawler is too triggering because I worked with those guys. Like, I know those guys. I remember coming out of that film and making a mental list of all the dudes who fit that exact Nightcrawler profile because you used to have to deal with them all the time on the crime beat. But yeah, really fascinating stuff. Can I ask you a quick question? This is like, you can cut this out. And maybe this is like, you know, revealing too much of what's to come in the Decade Project for the year of our Lord 2024. But in 2014, the films that you're looking at, is there anything that's like this in terms of it hasn't had an enduring legacy?
I'm gonna open the old notebook to where I have the entire list so far of what's there.
Because let me just throw some suggestions at you. Because the one I was going to say that hasn't necessarily had a legacy, or like there's a few that haven't had a legacy but are important to me, are The Drop, A Most Wanted Man, A Walk Among the Tombstones, They were all these sort of...
I would love to... you already have one that may have to be out, like, closer for the year next year. That has your name next to it.
I can't remember what it is. Can you tell me?
Interstellar.
Oh, my God. In my top five of all time. Yeah. Fuck yeah. But like the legacy, that film is more popular now than it was back then.
That film has grown.
90%
of music Instagram is guys in cafes playing Interstellar theme on pianos and like people reacting to it, which is crazy. But the one that, like, you said that, I love that you, Dead Man Down, I love that you call that because that one is fascinating because that is, it was actually a WWE Films production. That has a fascinating story because, like, they started branching out into films. Anyway, really fascinating. The big one that I think has absolutely no cultural footprint that I have on my list, and it's mainly because I like it, is Robert Downey Jr.'s The Judge.
Oh,
absolutely, you know, no cultural footprint.
I thought you were going to say Predestination because that is a film that, like Only Love Is Left Alive, felt humongous at the time.
Oh, it was humongous for both of us.
Yeah, but it genuinely did feel humongous amongst like the film girlies and gays and theys. And like it was the Sarah Snookification, like we're off to the races. And then it's so interesting now is like maybe it's because a decade later, in some perspectives, people feel like the Spielberg bros haven't fulfilled on the promise that they demonstrated with Predestination, which was considered like their film. But, like, you know, an elevated film of, like, everything that these guys are exciting dudes to watch, if you will. But The Judge, it's so funny you say that because I hear that get brought up quite a bit.
Do you?
Like, yeah. By dudes, only ever by dudes. Like, name a woman for $1, to quote Billy Eichner. But, yeah, only ever guys.
Name a woman for so funny.
Another, just one more quick question. You've got, I know like It Follows is the big horror project of that year, but like Housebound comes out that year as well.
Oh, Housebound is so good.
Truly one of the best New Zealand films.
So funny. Oh my
God. So good. 2014, so, banger, yeah.
2014 also, has a fucking insane lineup of movies.
Can I also Equalizer? One of my most like annual rewatchables in 2024. Like I rewatch that movie like, I don't know, once a month probs. But can I also just say, really hitting its stride for young adult cinema. And by stride, I mean crest. Because it's like, this trend is over, it's dying, it's dead. Because it's when Divergent comes out,
yes,
which I think is so kooky and fun, but is like, it's so funny to watch. And I've just rewatched it the other day.
I've never watched Divergent. I couldn't.
No, you could. You could. You know why? Jai Courtney's in there with a Proud Boys haircut and big stretchies in his ears. And the other reason, and Zoe Kravitz, one of her very early roles that convinces me she's not actually a good actress. She's just hot. And sometimes those things are hard to differentiate. Shailene Woodley's great.
What about Zoe Kravitz in Kimmy?
And what?
You a Kimmy fan?
It's okay. high fidelity is the thing for me. But Chloe Grace Moretz was also in that sick, like, I'm a violinist, but am I dead or am I alive if I stay? And, of course, the personal favorite for us, Vampire Academy, babes.
Yeah.
It's a fun year. It's a fun year.
Like, just on that list, like, the other ones that are, you know, and I will say this is actually good for the pod. So there's like in that year there's Gone Girl, of course.
Yeah, I mean, stop.
Grand Budapest Hotel, Nightcrawler, Ex Machina, What We Do in Shadows, Edge of Tomorrow, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, Chef, Guardians of the Galaxy. Like it's a banger of a year, and that's only like that's tip of the iceberg stuff. Like there's so many greats.
There were some also banger comedies like Bad Neighbors. Was so fun.
Very fun.
I remember having such a fun theatrical experience with you seeing that at the event.
Because Rose Byrne just charmed the fucking, like, just charmed the movie.
But it's not just her. It's also, like, the chemistry that her and Seth Rogen have. Zac Efron is so good in it. And then also Bad Neighbors 2 is really fun. When you have Chloe Grace Moretz and Beanie Feldstein and like the girls just being like feral gronks and shit. But top five is also a banger.
Can you explain like, feral gronks to international listeners?
Nah, I'm not here to do their homework for them.
Also, 22 Jump Street is that year.
Oh, my God, don't. One of my favorite films of all time.
So
I'm literally looking at my surfboard right now, which is named after a scene, one of the opening scenes from 22 Jump Street. My name's Jeff. So my surfboard is named El Jeff because of that scene.
The Guest.
Oh, stop. We need to end this so I can just go jerk off. I love that movie.
So amazing. And much. So just the other ones, like a couple of other, I mean, The Babadook is that year too. It Follows is probably the big one you've got there with.
I'm not doing The Babadook. You need to find someone else for that.
Kingsman. Which I know you'd love, the first one, is that year too.
I also love the prequel, which is now getting a sequel. And it is so funny because the prequel is getting a sequel and the prequel ended on a cutscene where they're like, dude, what's your name? And he's like, my name is Hitler. And I thought that was a bit where they were making fun of like cutscenes in movies and they're like, nah, we're going to do the Hitler sequel. And I was like, you guys are crazy. Z. You had that Elton John fight scene in the sequel, which the sequel's not good, but like my God, that scene just rips. Kingsman is such a good movie.
Other movies that are amazing. I remember I had such an amazing time watching Selma, so Ava DuVernay's film, which is outstanding, which is 2014.
Very
rewatchable. The Raid 2, which I think is one of the greatest
Our girl.
And one special to our hearts, Kevin Smith's Tusk is a 2014.
I feel, you know what's also important about Tusk is I feel like that is the end of our Kevin Smith era. Like that film.
It really is.
It really heralds the end of you and I.
It's like, we're good.
It was one of the formative things of our friendship when we first became friends. And Tusk. And like 2014 is when you and I are starting to drop off. That we, you know, some would say we're starting to grow up. Not I, Sam. Can I read you one Gone Girl tweet that just made me howl with laughter and is relevant to this?
Wait, we need to talk about two things though, just because that in next year it's Ouija or is the first one came out in 2014 and Lost River, Ryan Gosling's directorial debut. With Christina Hendricks and Saoirse Ronan.
We're not talking about those. Come on, get real. What? Ouija doesn't get good to the second one. And Lost River, girl, come on. What are we doing out here? Like, we don't need to talk about everything.
Okay. Go ahead.
Who's out here being like, hell yeah, man. Where are my Riverheads at?
I'm gonna find some Riverheads. I swear to God.
Ouija 2 is the one though, where things start to get really interesting.
For a future one. Yeah, go on.
Okay. I do love that you brought it up, though, but it's a hard no for me on your show that I don't run or work on. Okay, this tweet from Elizabeth Belsky, Lox Poli, if you are on the site called Twitter. I refuse to call it the other name. I am once again thinking about how if Taylor Swift moves to Missouri for Travis Kelce, it will literally be the plot of Gone Girl. You can't take an insane blonde who loves cryptic scavenger hunts out of the NY metro area. There will be a body count. Killed me. I've been thinking about that tweet like twice a day, every day since I read it. I was like, that is funny shit. Amazing Amy on Amazing Amy Taylor's version. Let's fucking go.
Oh, God. So, yeah, this is thank you for doing this. And you've helped me preview A, the reason why I want to keep doing this, but B, specifically, I think you said something pretty beautiful, which is that if what also instigated the show this year was a strange and a very thankful friendship with Macon Blair, who came on to talk. I originally just asked him to come on to talk Blue Ruin. I was like, could you come on and talk Blue Ruin for its 10th anniversary? And he's like, oh, I'll get Jeremy. Like as in the great Jeremy Saulnier to come on the show. And so then I invited Roxana Haddadi to come on, great critic, amazing voice that has been on so many of our shows. And we got to do a 10-year anniversary chat about Blue Ruin. And so you've just even more so committed to me that this is the place. If you have those 10-year movies now, they exist here. They exist on podcasts like this, where you go back and you go, well, I'm either going to talk to a great critic or a great author or a great screenwriter or all three of those things in one, or I'm going to see if I can talk to the filmmakers. And we might have some things up our sleeve to talk to some filmmakers about some stuff next year too.
And it's just also fun, when we get to the stage down the line where we get to do Jupiter Ascending, if you have anyone else on that show, I will literally riot in these streets. But it's there are things to appreciate about films, and sometimes it is something like Only Lovers Left Alive, where you feel the conversation has maybe died off. And if this gets five people talking about it, cool. And if not, fuck it, cunts. We had a wonderful hour and a bit getting to chat about our favorite emo vampires.
And look, for a person who just mentioned a 2015 movie, you mentioned Jupiter Ascending. This year literally has movies I know that you've watched 1,200 times.
It's got your boy Black Hat in there. Don't you be like, what came out in 2015? I know. I get a chill up my spine every time there's a Michael Mann film release. So I know the years perfectly.
No, you've got Mad Max Fury Road. You've got Sicario. Oh, you've got Creed, Spotlight. I know you've watched each year. It's crazy.
Magic Mike XXL, which was one of your best viewing experiences ever. Man from U.N.C.L.E., a personal fave of you and I.
Focus, deeply underrated, and the greatest behind-the-scenes story of all time.
One of my one of my absolute favorite Christmas films ever, The Night Before, which you want to talk about.
Oh, my God. An unseen gem.
And something where the conversation, I feel like, has died out of that. For 5 years there, we were really that was on every year and people would be talking about it. And they just do not talk about The Night Before. And it's just such a fucking good movie. Michael Shannon is Jesus. Just can't be beat.
The ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future. Bless him. Thank you so much for chatting. This is going to go live on our Patreon for everyone listening before the end of the year. So thank you for coming on for the last episode of the year. And then it'll get played in January. So folks who are listening to this, you're listening to early January before we dive into 2014 stuff next year. Do you have anything to plug? You want to plug away, my darling?
Yes, I do. Thank you for asking, Blake. My latest book, Assassin's Creed Mirage, Daughter of No One, is out now. If you're like, Assassin's Creed, boy, that title sounds familiar. Are they going to sue you? They are not, because it is an official tie-in novel to the latest Assassin's Creed game called Mirage. This is a completely original story set before the events of Mirage that follows the main character, Basim's mentor, Roshan, as she goes on a journey. It's great to be able to plug on this show with you, because you helped me finesse the pitch for it, which we were like, what about Ronin, but in 800s Persia? And somehow they paid me to do that. Anyway, that's available in
because ebook. Because you still, for whatever bizarre reason, sometimes have imposter syndrome. And I know how talented you are. So when you were asking about is this right? I'm like, yeah, homie, you write about your favorite 90s espionage thrillers in video game tie-ins. Do your version. Talk about Taylor's version. I want Maria's version of Ronin in the fucking ancient times.
It's just very hard to write a book that's set in, and I cannot stress this enough, 819, like the year of our Lord, 819. Do you know how many pop culture references you can make then? Fucking none, cunt. Fucking none. Nobody's got Letterboxd. You can't be you can't be making jokes about swiping right. It's 819.
Got Letterboxd.
As somebody who had a hard enough time, in high school, understanding the difference between BC and AD, this really stretched me in many ways, but I feel sometimes when your talent's at a 7 and the project requires it to be at an 11, it's a great opportunity for growth and progress. So you can access that book via ebook, via physical book, wherever you get good books from, and audiobook right now. My pop culture slasher, The Graveyard Shift, is also available. Endorsed by Patton Oswalt, Ratatouille himself. And what's the other book? Oh, Marvel's Mockingbird Strikeout is also available. And that is a novel about Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. Bobby Morse. Pew, 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 pew.
Pew, 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 pew. Well, thank you so much. You're the best. And we used to do Christmas shows. We used to do Christmas shows, but it feels like it's not Christmas until I've recorded the last podcast episode of the year with you. So here we are. More, 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 more. Love you. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.